tuna are among nature's fastest swimming fish, and billions of dollars worth of them swim in the Pacific Ocean until they are caught by faster-thinking fishermen. That the world's fishermen have become so good at thinking up ways to catch tuna leads us to ask, who should control the catching of the Pacific's protein?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned to the 992nd edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Port Villa who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Dave Michaels on the boards. Hello, Dave.
Glad to be here.
Hey, Dave, I have a question for you.
All right.
All right. Who do you think should control the catching of the Pacific tuna?
The fishermen, they would know best, I would think.
Fishermen, okay. Well, folks, good question. This just in, the government of Kiribati, an island nation way out there in the Pacific Ocean, has announced without any forewarning that it's forcing most of the American tuna fleet out of its waters and letting the Chinese and Taiwanese fleets take over. Though lacking the impact of that December 7, 1941 radio announcement of the attack on Pearl Harbor, it sounds to us as though the war for the Pacific's protein is on. Fact is, though tuna are among the ocean's fastest swimming fish, they simply cannot swim fast enough to escape being caught by the ocean's fast-thinking fishermen. And when it comes to catching the Pacific's tuna, the law of the seas appears to be one of catch as catch can. In fact, fishermen now catch over $7 billion worth of the Pacific's tuna every year. So good are fishermen at catching the world's fastest swimming fish, some say tuna species are becoming endangered. The fight for control over the Pacific's fishery appears to be to feature several different groups, one of which is the distant water fleets from Europe, United States, China, South Korea, and Taiwan. Another is the Pacific Island nations whose territorial waters contain the tuna. And, of course, like Dave Michaels says, fishermen, some of whom really do fish with a catch-as-catch-can ethic. This fight for the Pacific's protein leads us to ask, who should control the catching of the Pacific's protein? Well, today we have two very good advocates of the tuna population, Adam Bask, and also who is from the Sea Strong organization, and Joe Hamby, who is with Trimarine. Adam, let's start with you. Welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be here.
Great to have you aboard. Sea Strong, what is the Sea Strong?
So Sea Strong is an organization I recently launched that aims to work with clients on research, education, and policy initiatives that lead to better marine resource management and basically enhance the ocean environment. So we want to help organizations navigate the policymaking process, kind of help them amplify their message in a way that can make a positive impact. And I think one thing that Sea Strong firmly believes in is that fisheries can and should be a renewable resource, and they should result in a healthy and robust ocean environment. Those two things aren't, exclusive.
Well, I have a question for you then. Do you think there's anybody anywhere that thinks the fishery should not be a renewable resource?
You know, I don't think so. And I think that's the starting point you need to come from, is that, you know, in the end, everybody wants these fish and these ecosystems to be healthy and robust. The challenge is there's some, I wouldn't say fishermen or fishing companies, but certain entities out there that act in a way that is more in line with the short-term interest and making a quick buck than the long-term sustainability.
Yeah, and then if they were, though, it would seem like they wouldn't be in business very long if that were the case. If they caught all the fish and made all the money, that would be the end of the fishery, and that would be that.
You've seen that repeated time and time again in various fisheries around the world, and hopefully that won't be happening with Pacific tuna.
And that kind of happened with the cod fishery in the Atlantic, correct?
Well, correct. I mean, it happened several decades ago with the cod on the Grand Banks. And more recently, it looks like the cod in the Gulf of Maine are down to really historic low levels as well. And then this is with a lot of attention being paid on the population in terms of fisheries management and trying to keep this resource around for the future. And, you know, sometimes nature and the fishermen and the management bodies don't always cooperate.
Good enough. And we have to ask, who pays the way for Sea Strong?
Well, right now I'm working with some universities and international nonprofit organizations that work on sustainable seafood initiatives. And once some availability opens up, I'm looking to work with other businesses, foundations, governments who work in this arena as well.
Good to go. Also with us today, we have Joe Hamby, who's the Chief Operating Officer of Trimarine. Joe, welcome to the Food Chain.
Yeah, good morning.
Pleasure to have you aboard. Now, where is Trimarine headquartered?
Our headquarters are in Bellevue, Washington.
Up in the Seattle, north of Seattle there. Now, Trimarine is a fishing company, correct?
It's a vertically integrated tuna supply company. We have fishing boats, processing plants, and commercial offices all around the world.
Good. And you're just opening up a brand new plant in American Samoa. You're going to be canning up to a million cans a day. Did I read that right?
That's right. It's a large-scale tuna processing plant. It'll be one of the most modern tuna plants in the world. It'll be canning tuna that's caught in the Pacific Ocean.
Well, and one other thing I noted about Trimarine is that you take great pride in being a sustainable fishing company, and you have the support of a lot of nonprofit organizations, environmental organizations. But I just have to ask, if you have a plant that can put out a million cans of tuna every day, it would seem like not too many days all the tuna are going to be in cans.
Well, yeah, there is a lot of tuna. Much of the tuna is quite sustainable and will continue to be renewable, provided that the resource is managed properly. Trimarine has been a leader in the sustainability movement for tuna. We helped to found, for example, the International Seafood Sustainability Foundation with other companies, other fishing companies, the other tuna marketing companies, well-known brands like Starkus, Bumblebee, Chicken of the Sea in this market, and scientists. And World Wildlife Federation is one of the founding members of that.
Well, Joe, it would seem to be that you would benefit greatly by having a sustainable fishery. So I can't see why you would not be along those lines. Can you think of anybody that wouldn't be into having a sustainable fishery?
Well, the tuna industry is very global and international. There's a lot of different players. And you can, I guess, to simplify it, you can separate the actors into maybe four.
Good guys and bad guys?
Well, yeah, you could say that some guys are better than others. Some of the fishermen are usually regarded, I like your engineer's response on who should control it. I don't agree with that. Unfortunately, the fishermen, they do one thing, they fish. And they're very, very competitive. So they will, when there are controls, they'll figure out ways how to get right up to the edge of that control. And if no one's looking, and this is no offense to any fisherman who follows all the rules, but many of them will take advantage of the situation as it presents itself because it's not so easy to catch a fast-swimming tuna.
Wow. I always wondered about just how you go about catching a fast-swimming tuna, and perhaps we can pick that up. We're going to take a quick break here in just a bit. But Trimarine, one of the biggest tuna companies around, I have to ask a quick question. At one time, there was a tuna fishery here on the west coast of the United States, but it has since apparently moved away. Why is that, Joe?
Well, there's still a tuna fishery off the southern off of the west coast of the states. The one that you're talking about was the one that was Skipjack and Yellowfin which was a seasonal fishery, in the summer months, August, September, even into October. That fish, tuna migrates. My grandfather was a tuna fisherman in San Pedro, and like his other fishermen friends, they would, in the wintertime, they would simply head south. They would fish off of Mexico, and then after that, they'd go all the way down to Peru in search of the tuna and bring it back. The story is the...
Can you hold that story for just a second? We're going to take a quick break out of time on this segment. But what happened to the American fishery? We'll pick that up when we come back, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for the day. Today we're talking with Joe Hamby, who is with Trimarine. We're talking with Adam Bask, who is the founder of Sea Strong. And we're talking with you about tuna, about Pacific protein, about who should watch over the protein so that it's going to be there for our children. Do stay tuned. Right back.
Wow, MetroFarm.com says we can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
And we don't even have to own the land, we can lease it year to year.
MetroFarm.com says we can grow fruit on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, vegetables in city greenbelts, and ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
We can even grow flowers on our wooded hillside.
Get all the information you need to grow for profit at MetroFarm.com, including the complete guide to earning 5-, 6-, and 7-figure incomes by farming small parcels of land. Meet the farmers who earn the money. Find experts at MetroFarm.com who will examine your property and assess which crops to grow. Meet consultants who will help steer your project to profitability. And get the latest news about the business of growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
We've always dreamed about farming a small parcel of land. At MetroFarm.com, we can get all the help we need to stop dreaming and start growing.
Well, we had a tuna fishery here on the west coast of the United States, but it went away. It went far, far away. Why did it go away, Joe Hamby?
Well, the tuna around that was processed by thousands of workers in the Los Angeles area. There were 15 tuna canneries there until the mid-60s. At that time, the cost of labor grew to such a high level relative to other parts of the world that the tuna, instead of being brought back to San Pedro when the boats would fish down south, they would bring it to other places. For example, they took it to Puerto Rico. And then eventually the labor costs in Puerto Rico became so expensive, it migrated from there, just like the tuna was migrating all over the place.
So was it really too fresh fish, was it, if you had to catch it here on the West Coast and haul it to Puerto Rico? And
yeah, well, the tuna is caught. Typically the boats will go out for 30 to 60 days, and the fish that they catch is frozen on board, so it does...
Frozen fresh, yeah.
The quality is quite good when doing it that way.
Yeah. Well, Adam, what kind of tuna species are there that we seek out to eat?
Well, there's probably about five major ones that you'll be familiar with, and most consumers are familiar with. Whether or not they know the names is one thing. But the biggest population of tuna and the kind most commonly found in the can is called the skipjack. And that's a relatively small tuna. They reproduce quite quickly. And that's really the target of this big fishery that in the Pacific Ocean that, worth billions of dollars and where you have multiple fleets from countries all over the world targeting these things. Other species of tuna that are caught, you probably run across more in a sushi restaurant. So we're talking about yellowfin tuna and big-eyed tuna, which are commonly called ahi. Deeper red meat, oftentimes served in steaks. And then there's also the bluefin tuna, which might be the most well-known of the tuna species, but it is probably the worst shape biologically. And in the Pacific Ocean, it's down to only about 4% of historical levels due to overfishing.
So when we Google or when we do a search on tuna fishing, we see that there's a lot of trouble in the tuna fishery. It seems like everywhere tuna are really becoming harder and harder to catch and more less and less trouble there, it seems to be. So when we look at it, we realize, of course, that tuna must be very good to eat if we're fishing them so intensively. And yet some of the questions that come up when we talk about tuna fishing is the mercury that is found in tuna. I guess this would be a good question for you, Joe. How do you and the industry resolve that one when people say can't eat tuna anymore because of the mercury?
Well, that's a lot of misinformation about mercury. It's easy to say, well, there's a lot of mercury in tuna, but the mercury is naturally occurring in the ocean. And the longer-lived fish accumulate naturally the mercury because of where they swim. The faster and shorter-lived tuna, like skipjack, have very little opportunity to accumulate mercury. So there is very low levels of mercury, or even no mercury in the skipjack species, as opposed to, say, a long-lived fish like a bluefin or a big eye or maybe yellowfin. Those, if it's an old enough fish, it will have the chance to accumulate mercury while swimming through the ocean. There's another piece of that that isn't, and maybe Adam can speak more to this, but in tuna, of course, people eat tuna because it's a protein, and it's very nutritious. It has omega-3s for brain development. And there's another element in tuna called selenium. And selenium is a compound that where mercury is eliminated from the body. It is not absorbed by the body. And so when you talk about mercury, I like to tell people about the Japanese who eat a lot of tuna. They're some of the they're well known for being very bright and living a long time. So I think if mercury is a problem in tuna, then why is it that the Japanese are not having a problem with it?
Adam, you want to pick up that one?
Yeah, sure. And I'm not sure about the mercury, and I think it was a selenium issue. But one thing that's, I think, not really on the radar of a lot of fisheries managers or consumers is that, how does mercury get in the ocean? Well, the answer is a lot of it trickles down from the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And mercury is especially given off in coal-fired power plants. So as more and more coal-fired power plants are erected overseas and in China, the more mercury that's going to be in the atmosphere, the more that's going to go into the ocean. So I agree that a lot of these faster-growing species like the skipjack don't have issues with mercury, but I also think that mercury levels are on the rise, unfortunately, and that's not something fisheries managers can do anything about.
Yeah, I guess the problem with the Pacific Ocean is that it's downwind of China.
Yeah.
Something like that. And perhaps when people go to the sushi restaurant for their bluefin, they should instead ask for a can of skipjack tuna. Might be healthier for them that way. So let's talk a little bit about how in the heck you catch these things, because being a fisherman myself and love to go out and catch a fish once in a while, I often wondered how you go about catching a fish that swims so fast, like the tuna. How do you go? Where do you catch them? Do they swim out there in the deep blue, or do they hang around the island nations? I guess, Joe, that's a question for you.
Oh, I'm glad you asked that question. With the tuna, the majority of the tuna is caught between the bands of north 10 degrees of the equator and south 10 degrees of the equator in these tropical waters all around the world. More than half of the tuna is caught in the Pacific Ocean, that being the biggest ocean. The way you catch it, the fish is migratory, and it migrates to feed, and so it will migrate wherever they can find food. And most of the tuna is caught well outside the territorial seas of islands. It's caught in either the high seas or in the exclusive economic zones of Pacific islands, like the one you mentioned, Kiribati. Well, you say Kiribati, I say Kiribati. That's how they pronounce it, and out of respect to the people of Kiribati, I pronounce it that way.
Kiribati?
Kiribati. The T is silent in the...
Kiribati. Okay. Yeah. I'll try to be correct. Kiribati. Yeah.
And that's famous for Tarawa, the famous
sure.
World War II battle.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, fishes in those EEZs of island countries like Kiribati, and the way you catch it is either by having a sharp eyes where you can see the birds just like you would if you go out of Santa Cruz. If you're looking for bird activity, under the birds are usually over the bait, and if there's bait in the water, there's fish trying to eat the bait. That's one way. And you do that with helicopters. You do that. Some people are even experimenting with drones. You do that from the crow's nest with super powerful binoculars. The other way is fishing using fish aggregating devices. These have been the so-called FADs, and that we can talk a lot about FADs.
Fish aggregating devices? How does that work? I have to go get one.
Yeah. The fish aggregating devices can be anything as simple as a raft that you put in the ocean. And
gotcha.
it creates a little,
starts a food chain, right?
Yeah, it starts a food chain. The shade, I mean, in the tropical waters, the sun is beating down there, so if you're a little animal, you get under that shade, and then pretty soon another animal comes, and another, and pretty soon you have a whole social system of different species of fish, including tuna. The problem with that is that it also aggregates non-target species, some of which are overfished, mm-hmm. like the silky shark.
So how do we get the tuna from the sea into the boat?
Well, let's focus on skipjack. Most of the skipjack is caught by purse seiners. A purse seiner typically is a boat that is anywhere from 100 to over 200 feet in length. It can carry 1,000 to 1,500 tons of tuna. It has a skiff on the stern, and the stern is a ramp, so that's when you find the tuna, that purse seiner will release the skiff, and when that skiff is released, it's attached to the end of a long net, a purse net, and that skiff hits the water. The purse seiner is still going about 10 knots ahead. So it'll pull the net right off the back of the purse seiner, and the purse seiner will make a big, big circle.
And there you have all those fish trapped in the net. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Are we catching enough, or are we catching too much? Right back. Do stay tuned. Well, one thing is for certain, we are getting very good at catching fish, and we're catching a lot of them. $7 billion worth of tuna every year we're catching, and we're processing them in places like American Samoa, where Tri-Marine's building a brand new plant, going to be able to put out 1 million cans of tuna every day. That's a lot of tuna, if you think about it. So it must be a very interesting operation, because you must bring the pieces of all of that production in from all over. You need tin cans, and you don't get it in American Samoa, do you, Joe?
There is a can-making plant in American Samoa for certain sizes, but most of the cans that we will be using at our cannery will be coming from other places, including the States.
So why have we focused our tuna industry in American Samoa?
As I was talking earlier about the migratory nature of tuna and how tuna processing has kind of followed the cost of labor, there has been tuna processing in American Samoa for over 50 years. The boats that would fish out of San Pedro, some of those, instead of going all the way south, they went out west where they found tuna. And when they were way out west, what better way to improve their profitability than by unloading it locally? So what we've done, we bought a cannery that used to be owned by Chicken of the Sea. This was about 5 years ago. We tore down that old cannery and we're putting up this new cannery. Taking advantage of the fact that American Samoa is a traditional mm-hmm. source of tuna processing.
It's interesting. Almost all of the canning facilities have disappeared from the United States and have gone someplace else. And I guess this is just another indication of that trend, wherein the costs of production are so high you just can't do it here, so you go someplace where you can do it, and that would be American Samoa. What about the extent to which we're able to catch fish? Adam, how are we doing? I Googled tuna fishing, and it seems like tuna fish is in trouble everywhere. Am I wrong?
Well, you know, there's a lot of species of tuna, and some are definitely in trouble, and some are not. And I think it's important to make that distinction. We don't want to say, you know, all tuna fishing is bad or unsustainable. I don't think that's the case at all. But there are some species in significant trouble. Like we talked about before, there's the bluefin. There's actually three species of bluefin, Atlantic, Pacific, and Southern bluefin, found off of the south coast of Australia. And those are all in pretty rough shape and have been subject to years of overfishing and are hopefully rebounding in some regions. But, yeah, those are definitely, you know, more endangered than some of the others. One of the big issues in the Pacific Ocean is big-eye tuna. So I talked earlier that the big-eye tuna are usually sold in sushi restaurants. But the small ones are caught by the purse seine fisheries going after the skipjack tuna, specifically when they use fish aggregating devices or those FADs. FADs attract sharks, they attract juvenile tunas, they can attract other vulnerable marine species. And I think one of the big challenges is that, you know, how do you get a handle on this fishing gear that makes the operations much more efficient, but also is a threat to the overall ecosystem? And right now there really aren't any effective controls on the amount of FADs that can be put in the ocean or the amount of FAD fishing that can be done in a given year. And that's something that a lot of the conservation organizations are concerned about right now. But I would say bluefin's the biggest concern, and big eyes up there as well.
Well, Adam, you said something that kind of caught my attention, and that is trying to talk fishermen into being less intelligent about how they go about catching fish. Joe, that would seem to be a difficult job, you know, to talk tuna fishing into using less effective fish catching devices. You see any possibility in that?
Oh, of course. I think everyone recognizes that tuna is renewable, a great renewable nutritious resource for this planet, provided that it's well managed. The fishermen are not going to self-manage. That management of tuna species has to be done by someone else. And we weigh in on the side of the island countries. I'm talking about the Pacific. The island countries where the tuna is caught should take that responsibility. They have the most to gain and the most to lose. Tuna is talking about Kiribati, for example. Their total national budget every year is about $110 million. And almost $100 million of that budget comes from access fees from tuna.
So that's very,
very
important.
Very important. Yeah.
Well, that brings up the next interesting notion then, because what spurred me to pick on this subject was a press release or a little item in the news about Kiribati kicking the American fleet out in favor of the Chinese fleet. And I got to thinking, why would they do that? Well, there's only really one reason, right? And that would be money. So is this what we're seeing out in the Pacific then, the tuna going to the highest bidder now? Joe?
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, money is a big part of it. We have recognized that these island countries have usually two choices when it comes to tuna. They can sell access to the highest bidder and just take the money and then use it as they see fit, whatever the public policy requires. The other choice is to create jobs from the tuna resources, like building canneries or doing processing of tuna other than canning, where you can create jobs for the people and let everyone decide how to spend their money instead of the government deciding everything for them. This is what happened in American Samoa, where American Samoa, the reason that the tuna industry is so important there is because they don't have other opportunities. Over 75% of the private sector is employed by the tuna industry, so if there's no tuna there, You can imagine how what a devastating impact it would have on American Samoa.
Yeah. Well, Adam, what do you think? Joe seems to think that the best way to control all of this is through the island nations in which the fish swim. What do you think?
No, I agree 100%. I think the fish are really their lifeblood and their future. I think Kiribati is one example of an island nation that has a huge reliance on the fishing license fees and has the most to gain from it. Other small countries like Nauru and Tokelau and the Solomon Islands, which has, more going on than just fishing, but it's a big part of it. There's a number of countries out there that are really reliant on these, on the access and the fishing, whether it's building local industries or licensing kind of the distant water players to go and catch that for them. And I think that story you saw about, China now getting more days in Kiribati than the U.S., I think just might point to the relevance of the island countries actually banding together and making those decisions on, who they're going to work with and who they're going to grant access to based on who gives them the best deal and the most opportunities for their future. And I think what that deal shows is that maybe the deal the U.S. was giving them isn't as good as they're getting from other countries.
There you go. So money's going to be talking. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, and you are invited to participate in our discussion about tuna. Phone number's 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Pick up your phone and join us.
Frank Muller has been farming in Woodland with his brothers Louie and Tom for as long as they can remember.
We've been farming since we were kids, but the college years at UC Davis were the big years because what we learned there, we brought home. Today, we're still working to make farming more productive and friendlier for the environment. Yeah, the future of agriculture looks good.
Find out how UC Davis partners with growers like the Mullers at onecalifornia.ucdavis.edu.
Well, it seems like there is a contest going on now, or at least that would be what I have seen in the news between Kiribati. Did I pronounce that right, Joe?
Kiribati.
And in the small island nation out there in the Pacific, east of Fiji out there, south of Hawaii, and right in the tuna zone. And they have a lot of tuna. And it used to be a great fishing ground for the American fleet and New Zealand fleet, but from what we read in the news, they've been kicked out in favor of the Chinese fleet. And that would be an issue for you, would it not, Joe, with Trimarine building a brand new plant in American Samoa? Goodness, you've lost a chunk of fishing ground there.
Yeah, there's a couple of things. We'll just focus on Kiribati, but that was our traditional fishing grounds for the boats that are based in American Samoa, these U.S. flag purse seiners. Now, with Kiribati making the decision not to support the U.S. treaty that we've had for the past 27 years, that basically takes Kiribati out of the equation. So the boats will have to find other places to fish, or we will have to make so-called bilateral agreements with Kiribati, where the U.S. government was not able to make a good agreement. When I say a good agreement, one that provided adequate fishing access to Kiribati, maybe individual companies will be able to do that in competition to other countries like China.
Oh, so they're really, it's kind of like a free agency in sports, right? Everything is going to go to the highest bidder.
Yeah, we hope that we will ultimately prevail in terms of partnering with these resource owners so that we can create jobs in their countries, not just pay them access fees.
Right. Quick question for Adam. In thinking about this, how this is going to be managed, you see where a small nation like this decides to pass a different kind of arrangement. We're going to now work with the Chinese and the Taiwanese, and we're going to kick the Americans out. Now, of course, the question is, how on earth are they going to enforce anything? Are they going to use their giant navy to enforce the discipline of the seas?
You know, that's a great question. And enforcement on these vast ocean areas is a huge challenge. But I think what the Pacific has more than a lot of other regions in the world is actually a great history of cooperation and coordination on not only management of the fisheries, but also on monitoring and enforcement. So, of course, Kiribati and some of these other small countries don't have huge navies or coast guards that can go and enforce or go and inspect every vessel that's fishing out there. But all of these large vessels have a fisheries observer on board that's there to collect the data on what's happening. They also have, satellite transmitters on board so, the managers of the fishery can see where these vessels are at any given time. And if there is suspicious-looking activity that happens, well, then they can get inspected when they go into port. And actually, the whole fishery is monitored by this unit based in the Solomon Islands. And I've been there. You walk in, and there's this huge, movie screen up on the wall that shows all the fishing boats throughout the entire Western Pacific up on the screen on a big map. And there's green dots for the ones that are following the rules, yellow ones for ones where they have some questions about, and red dots for the vessels that have clearly violated some of the management measures and, are going to be required to get inspected and answered for those actions once they come into port. So I think there's actually a really well coordinated management and enforcement effort going on in that region. That's definitely more so than you see in other fisheries that happen on the high seas, such as in the Eastern Pacific or in the Atlantic Ocean.
Joe, I've seen photographs of that screen in American Samoa with a featuring all of the boats out at sea. Wow, it looks like a giant city out there, an amazing number of boats. How do those boats go about getting their red dot? Who discovers that they're doing things wrong? How do you know?
Yeah, the enforcement is as much an art as it is a science. The fishermen are clever. They all are supposed to have these transponders on them. Sometimes the transponders don't work, or maybe they're not, maybe intentionally put out of order so the boats can dart into someone's EEZ to fish and come back out again. Maybe that's one way to get a red dot. I really don't
by
know.
Turning off your transponder, like the Malaysian Airlines did, to disappear. Simple
right.
as that. You know, I was in kind of thinking about this program. I was watching a brief presentation on a video about Mozambique, and the local fishermen in Mozambique talking about how their fish have essentially disappeared, and they talked about. They kind of point to the fingers of these giant factory ships that linger off their shores in the middle of the night. Are they just whistling Dixie there, or are those big ships really sneaking in close to shore and harvesting the fish that live off the reef like that? Adam, what do you think?
No, I think that's a real concern. You hear reports of that, especially in Africa. And I think there's a number of organizations and governments working to, reverse that trend and get that fishery more monitored. But I would think the Pacific tuna fishery is one of the examples of a large international fishery, that's relatively well monitored. I mean, you wouldn't have that kind of activity necessarily happening right off the shores of the Solomon Islands, I wouldn't think.
So it sounds like you two pretty much agree on everything. How did I manage that?
Trimarine is a sustainably oriented, vertically integrated tuna company. I want my children...
Hold that thought. We're going to pick it up when we get back. Can we sustain the fishery? Do stay tuned.
Hi, folks. How many of you out there love to garden? Wouldn't it be nice to grow some of your own food? Or maybe a flower garden would brighten your day. Well, now you can have the pleasures of gardening without all that effort. You don't need a tractor. You don't need a rototiller. All you need is the Knox Garden Box, a heavily constructed, portable, elevated garden on legs that can virtually change the way you've gardened in the past. The Knox Garden Box can be set up anywhere. Yes, you can place it right on concrete. For those with bad backs, you've got critters and gophers, no space or maybe no dirt. With the Knox Garden Box, the therapy of garden is now the prescription for good mental health. The way to find your fabulous Knox Garden Box is by logging on to knoxgardenbox.com. That's K-N-O-X, gardenbox.com. Or by calling 831-461-9430.
Hey, there's my son. You've been in your room all morning.
Hey, Dad.
Matt, what's wrong with your voice?
There is nothing wrong with my voice.
Oh, well, it's just sort of...
I have been playing my video games and electronic games for so many hours.
Uh-huh. Well, it sounds like it might be time for you to take a break, or...
Hello, Dad.
Susan?
I have been watching TV and text messaging all morning. Yay, electronics. Yay.
Guys, I think it's about time to get in the car and take a little trip. Maybe see some trees, some green things.
What are these green things you speak of?
This weekend, unplug. Take your family to the forest. There's nothing in the world like experiencing nature firsthand. Trees, paths, bluebirds, streams. Getting closer to nature can get you closer to your family. To find the forest nearest you, go to discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Well, if you think about it, and you don't have to think very hard or very far, you got to realize that we haven't been doing a very good job of husbanding our resources with respect to the world's fisheries. I mean, look around, and we fished a whole bunch of things pretty much out of existence, and we have a lot of them that are truly endangered right now, not least of which is that delicious bluefin tuna where we go to the sushi restaurant and spend a lot of money to buy a little piece of bluefin tuna. So the question I have to ask is it going to be possible to save the tuna fishery out there in the vast Pacific, that skipjack fishery that puts all of that tuna in those little cans that we love to have make our tuna fish sandwich out of? The competition for that protein is becoming, you know, more fierce as we go along, because China can now afford to essentially compete with us for the fisheries and is winning in some places. So with all of this money going after all of those fish, and with all of our fishermen becoming so incredibly smart at finding ways to catching those fish, are we going to be able to sustain the fishery? Adam, start with you.
You know what? Right now, I think the biggest threat to sustaining the fishery is limiting the number of boats that continue to enter the fishery. I think, you know, right now there's about 300 of these large purse seine vessels and you know, a couple thousand longline vessels. And we didn't even talk about longline, right. And this is a whole other issue of sustainable fishing and tuna. You know, the purse seiners are the large, very efficient vessels that have the technology on board to scoop up, you know, hundreds of tons of fish every day if they get lucky and the fish are under the fat or they see a big school. And unless you really rein in that number of vessels, I think you're going to be testing the limits of sustainability for the skipjack tuna, which is and should be a resilient and productive fishery that should be renewable for generations to come. But I think we are approaching those limits. And not only will we have to worry about bluefin and big eye, but Skipjack and Yellowfin could be the next victims if the number of fishing boats isn't reined in.
Joe Hamby, you're the fisherman. What do you think?
I absolutely agree. Again, with Adam, the problem is capacity measured in numbers of vessels. The Pacific Island countries who are selling fishing days want to see more and more vessels to keep compete for those days, because then that drives the price up. I think that's a short-term policy that is not good for the fishery in the long run. They absolutely have to address the limit on the number of boats. And we hope to be able to achieve that through some of these regional fishery management organizations.
So you were suggesting earlier that it should be the island nations that control the catch. But if it's in the island's interest to have more boats fishing to drive up the price, it would seem like that would be counterintuitive to sustainability. Am I wrong?
You know, in the short term, it's good for them. They earn more money. In the long term, if earning more money means depleting the resource, they've failed.
Wow. Well, there it is, folks. This has been the Food Chain Radio program. We've been talking about the Pacific tuna fishery, a wonderful source of protein for the world, but we're so good at catching it, we're catching it into oblivion. Adam Bask with us today, founder of Seastrong LLC. Also, Joe Hamby, chief operating officer, Tri-Marine, building a brand new facility out there in American Samoa. And, of course, we thank you for joining us as well. We want you to all remember Michael Olson's second law of the food chain. The farther we go from the source of our food, the less control we have over what's in that food. See you more all next week for more What's Eating What Radio right here in the Food Chain.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.